Now, speaking of service work, as a result of my history in service, I met an awful lot of people. In 1995, and starting in 94, we know we had the International AA International Convention with Al-Anon participation down in San Diego. And I had the privilege to work on that convention as Al-Anon coordinator, and I got to meet, like I say, 1,000 kids from all over the world. But the reason I was able to do that, there was a lady who had seen me at the World Service Assembly, who also was the one at that assembly in 1996, was the fall of 96, that I was going to the restroom and she stopped and gave me a hug and said, "You're gonna stand for delegate, aren't you?" And I had said, "I don't know." So anyhow, I did stand, and I was chosen your Southern California Al-Anon delegate to serve for you at the World Service Conference from 1997, 98, and 99. And from that experience, I got to meet, going down to working on that convention, I got to meet both Pat and Cliff. Don't know which one of you guys are going first, but Cliff is going to do it first. So at this time, Cliff was also the AA liaison. So at this time, I'd like to introduce you with great honor and privilege to introduce Cliff Roach.
Shame on you. Hi, my name is Cliff Roach, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Cliff.
One of them. Pleasure to be here. Wow, great crowd. Sorry your potluck didn't turn out. Congratulations on your 20th anniversary. Very grateful to be included in this. A lot of good old friends. I'm very confused. He said that babysitters go into revolt if we don't quit at 8:30. I love it when they know what they're doing. They told us we were each going to get like 40 minutes, so...
Go for it.
I was raised in a terrible alcoholic home. Oh, really? Yes. I know many of you had a drunken father or a drunken mother. I had a drunken father and a drunken mother, and it was a zoo, it was a crazy place, and I grew up crazy. My Al-Anon, I like to call her my Al-Anon. You know how you guys do it. Have you met my alcoholic sit-up boy? Tell him how long you've been sober. I got sober in January 13th, 1970, and my wife didn't come in till March, so. And we have a deal, if it's an AA meeting and we're both to share, she goes first, and if it's an Al-Anon meeting, I go first, so you don't say anything smart aleck when somebody else has the mic after you. And I was raised in a zoo, and I was a crazy man, and I started drinking when I was 16. They're coming in the program now at 16, but I started at 16. I never drank successfully, ever. Oh yes, I did. I had a lot of fun. Lots and lots of good times drinking. A lot of times we forget to talk about that. Hey, you know. Oh, but I always got to that drink, and I never knew what drink that was. Was it the fifth or the seventh? But I always knew when I got to it. I always knew my brain would say, "This is the one. You drink this one, you're going to do tricks." And I always said, well, you know. And after that, I have a few more, and then I just go insane and just wreck cars and get beaten to a pulp on a regular basis and just awful, terrible stuff. I met my Al-Anon when we were in college. She was down on Skid Row looking for an alcoholic to abuse her. You're looking to be abused. You got your boy here, I'll tell you for sure. And we entered this 20-year suicide pact. We had a dual disease. We had alcoholism and Catholicism. We had a kid every 9 months and 20 minutes. And they grew up crazy too. And so toward the end of my drinking, I was a school teacher, a very successful school teacher, if there's such a thing. No, I was a hell of a good teacher. I was a high school teacher, and somebody asked my wife one time, why is your husband such a good high school teacher? And she said, well, he's a very well-educated adolescent. But coming in the home stretch, I got drunk at home every night. And I'm a mean drunk, and I'm a foul-mouthed, critical, sarcastic, violent drunk. And I got drunk at home every night. So when we got here, no human power could have relieved my family. We were all nuts. I was the head nut, but she wasn't too far behind. Okay. She had one of those pre-Al-Anon texts. You know, we let her go downtown. It's a Marine town. She got doing that, getting a lot of trouble. And my oldest son was working his way to high school as a hashish salesman. Never had to give him any spending money, I'll guarantee you. I should hit him up for a fifth about once a week. Yeah, Dad, what do you need? Oh, you should have seen him. He had hair down to his butt, you know. Dad went like this all the time. Call his mother, man. Hey, man, what's for dinner? Oh, you should have been. He loved LSD. Oh, they're funny, those guys. And I'd be right in the middle of a sentence, he'd say, what was that? Of course, the shape I'm in by then, I'd say, I don't know, what was it? And her mother lived with us, and she was a heavy drinker. And she would say, I'll explain it. One time we got a hysterical thing in back. We used to listen to the explanation, for God's sake. I was one of the top three debate coaches in the United States. I became a debate coach, top debate coach by mistake. The first time I took some kids to a speech tournament down 30 miles down the road at San Diego State. I was a newcomer there and they all snubbed me. But one guy was kind of the guru there. Gray hair, you have beautiful gray. Steel gray hair, have about $1,000 suit on. He was the only one that spoke to me. Fine, sure. He said, where are you from? I said, Oceanside. He said, oh, where's that? 30 miles up. So I went back to Oceanside High and I built me a speech team. It took me 4 or 5 years and a lot of booze. And I built a juggernaut speech team, is what I did. I built this powerhouse speech team, and I did it with sheer hatred. And then I destroyed the family in the meantime, and so 4 or 5 years later, I talked to this guy, the gray-haired guy, and I said, my team had just won a tournament. There were 25 schools in the tournament. My team scored more sweepstakes points than the other 24 schools combined. This is 4 or 5 years later. I went up to that gray-haired guy and says, you know where Oceanside is now? He just looked blank. He said, what are you talking about? I said, 4 or 5 years ago, you said to me, Oceanside, where's that? He said, we just moved here from Nebraska. I didn't know where. Identify too. But I'd been in and out of AA for 5 years. I was just a perfect AA loser. You know, I had it all down. I'd sit in the last chair in the last row, had a little head bob going, you know, smirk. And in and out, and in and out. I'd come for AA for 40 days, and I'd be drunk for 2 years. Then I'd come in for 30 days, and I'd be drunk for a year and a half. And, you know, everybody knew me, and I knew what a loser I was. I was just a classic loser. But finally, things just got so horrible in our family. One night, I threatened to move out. Any other alcoholic here used to threaten to move out? Used to work. She would say, oh, well, we can talk it over. But that night, I said, I'm moving out. She forgot her lines. I said, perhaps you didn't hear me. I better just move out. I said, okay, I'm going tomorrow. She said, what's the matter with tonight? So, you know, you can't run a bluff. I moved out. And I'm living down at the beach where I wanted to live anyway with my surfboard. I was a surfer dude. And my life started slipping between my fingers. I was drunk all the time. I never missed work before, and I was missing work. And I went by the house one afternoon, and I was haranguing her about money. And the hashish salesman was kind of bobbing in the background there. Humming a tune from the planet Pluto. And dumbest thing I ever did in my life, I turned to my 16-year-old son and I said, Dave, what's it like not to have your old man around the house? And my son looked me right in the eye and he said, it's beautiful. And I'm standing here 41 years plus sober because that 16-year-old kid had the guts to tell me what I was. And I'll be forever grateful. And I went back to that dump on the beach and ranted and raved, but I didn't take a drink that afternoon. And I went out and sat on the screen porch and watched, still today, the most beautiful sunset I have ever seen. And about the time the sun was going down into the water, I had that moment of clarity that the Big Book talks about. And I realized that I'd given up my own self-respect. Thank you, I already have one. Cheers. And, Jack and I have been pals a long time. And when the sun was going down, I realized I'd given up my own self-respect a long time before my son. And so I went in the bedroom, dug out the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I had read. Being an English teacher, I thought it was very poorly written. Oh, it read a lot better this time. And I read the Big Book for 3 days and three nights. I called in sick. I didn't go to work. I ate a little bit and slept even less. And I read the Big Book cover to cover. I read all the stories. I read the appendix in the back. And in the second edition, there was a story called The Professor and the Paradox. He was another egotistical school teacher. And on the third time through the book, on the 13th of January, 1970, at 3 o'clock in the morning, I was on page 63 again. And if you're new, page 63, there's a little prayer, which is step 3. I always called it the formal terms of surrender. And I knelt down on that filthy linoleum floor on that beach where I was living, and I read the third step out loud. I said, God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as you will. Relieve me of the bondage of self. And I've been around here a long time, and I sponsored lots and lots and lots of men. And the number one defect of character of every man I've ever worked with is self-obsession. That's the alcoholic story, self-obsession. What your problem is, I don't know. And I don't care, really. But on my knees that morning, I had a spiritual awakening. I had a sudden spiritual awakening, nothing like Bill Wilson had. I just knew I was going to be all right. And that night, I went to this little guy, Bill Blake's house. Every time I was in and out in AA, he'd pounce on me. You know that kind? When you're new, you hate those guys. Hi. He was always saying idiot things to me, like, you want to go to Los Angeles with us tomorrow? No. what I wanted to say is I can't stand you jerks here. Why would I drive 100 miles to see some Aria? But I just say no thank you. And I didn't like him. And that night I'm in his door, knocking. And Margie, Bill's wife, opened the door, and here I am on the porch. 5-year loser. A loser's loser. And if you're new tonight, I have never seen anyone so glad to see me in my life. She just lit up. Oh, Cliff! Oh! In the house I go. Pours me a cup of coffee. Oh, this is great. Oh, this is what. Bill's been crazy lately. He's had nobody to work with. Oh, this is so cool. And then Bill comes in. Wow, Cliff! About half an hour, I'm thinking, anything else I do to help you folks out? I help anyone I can. And that was the last nice thing the man ever said to me. That was it. Till the day he died. The first 5 years, the nicest thing he said to me was, shut up. Shut up. I told him, I have degrees, you know. He says, so does a thermometer, you know, where they stick out sometimes. I thought the first step was, shut up and get in the back of the car. You know, there's a method to that too, you know. He always said, the back seat on the hump. And you know, if you're the new guy and you're on the hump in the back seat, you become a 12-stepper. You find another guy, say, hey, come with us. That'll make a 12-stepper out of you. And he took me to a meeting every night for 2 years. We went to a meeting every night. First it was just me, and then Al got sober, then Pat got sober, then the other Al got sober. We had like 3 carloads of guys. We went everywhere in Southern California. He took me to meetings where people were having a good time. He knew me. The laughter, huh? Mm-hmm. I've met you guys before too, and I know about this group. The laughter, I can't live without it, I'm sorry. That's the spiritual part of the program as far as I'm concerned. I like to get me some new scuzzbag guy and take him to a meeting, take him to another meeting, take maybe the 12th or 13th meeting, he's sitting there beside me and he goes, gotcha! Al-Anons are more fun too. She's as mean as I am. We get these new little Al-Anon gals, we take them to AA speaker meetings like this, and we get her in between us so she can't escape. And on some clown like me up here, I fell in the Christmas tree and smashed all the presents. And we're all going, ah! And this new little Al-Anon sitting there. Not funny to her. So we take her to another meeting tomorrow night. One night she throws her head back and laughs. I don't care, hey, or Al-Anon, once we get you laughing, we gotcha. That's the spiritual part of the program to me. Nothing, the stuff I used to lie awake all night with my guts churning, my teeth grinding, it's funny now and the hell with it. Once I laugh at it, it's gone forever and I don't have to worry about it. And so I was such a fortunate man to get that little guy for a sponsor. He's been dead now, what, 22 years? And I miss him every day. But he hauled me to a meeting every night and he took me through the 12 steps until he was happy. Not me. And he was so cruel to me, thank God. And he took me into a meeting every night. And he used to take me up to Clancy's meeting on Tuesday nights, but it was Tuesday night then, and we'd go up on Saturday and play ball. Clancy was his sponsor. I don't hold that against him. So, you know, Clancy is so kind to me, I'd never thank him enough. But we'd go up there and play ball, and then we'd stay for Saturday night meeting. The girls would come up, and we'd all go to the meeting together. And that's the way it went. Whatever was wrong in my life, and I had lots wrong when I was new. I owed $1 billion, and I didn't have a brass razoo, and she wouldn't go to Al-Anon, had a mean mouth, and had all these dope fiend children. And I'd go to my sponsor's house and bang on the door. You know what they're doing over there now? And he would say, come on in, Cliff. Tell me all about it. So I'd launch forth for maybe half an hour sobbing, telling him all my troubles. He would listen. Yeah, they listen. I found it's good to make a little noise once in a while, like, huh? And they think you're paying attention. But he never interrupted me. He'd let me run down. And he would say, go get Al and take him to the meeting. What the hell? What's that got to do with a nervous breakdown? Like asking a guy, what time is it? The horse is dead. I hated Al. He was a jerk. He'd been slipping 10 years. I only slipped 5. And he had no driver's license, of course. And he was a big bullhorn. So I'd go get Al, drive him to the meeting, and listen to him all the way to the meeting. Blah, 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 blah. And then we'd sit through the meeting, and everybody'd go home, and we'd set the meeting down, wash the coffee. But we had real cups. And he had to do the washing because he was so shaky. He just put his hands in the water. But I could dry. You knew you got to feel better than somebody. So I'd load the blowhard in the car and drive him home. Blah, 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 blah. And I'd let Al off. And I'd start driving home. And this feeling would come over me. Would start like right here. And it would just spread out through my body. It felt better than the drink ever did. It felt better than a drink ever did. It only would last 40 seconds, you know. I thought it was because I got rid of Al. But whatever is wrong in my life, he told me to do something for you. You know, if you spilled your coffee, I mopped it up. I washed the cups, and I washed the coffee pots, and I went with him on all these 12-step calls. I was talking to somebody today about, you know, I had like 90 days, and I would stand by, and when we'd go on a 12-step call, he'd 12-step the guy. Guy would finally say, well, how long have you been sober? And he would say, 8 years. You just see the guy like, pfft. And he'd say to me, how long have you been sober? I'd say, 90 days. 90 days? Wow! So I was just a dummy. And whatever's wrong in my life, he told me to go get Al or do something for you, on and on and on. And it's called service. That's why I was glad you had the guys who do service stand up here. It's kind of a secret code word we use for love. Service. And he made me do a lot of service. He got me into formal service. I became a GSR, and then I was a DCM, and then I did the whole alphabet. And Linda ended up being the delegate for our area in panel 26, just before the Ice Age. And my buddies used to rag on me. They'd say, oh, here comes the AA politician. How's the politics doing, Cliff? They were only kidding. But I would say to my buddies in those days, I would say, I do this because I want AA to be here for my kids, if they need it. And I want it to be AA. I don't want it to be some watered-down, psychologized BS. I want it to be the program the little electrician brought to me, 1 through 12. I want it to be AA. Our youngest son has 23 years of sobriety. There's a lot more. Don't start applauding yet. Our middle daughter had 12 years at one time and has been trying to get back ever since and is having a very, very difficult time. And the hashish salesman has almost 10 years. He's one of the foremost experts in the world on the growing of coffee. He'd say, oh, what it used to grow. He's in Africa as we speak right now. He is in this outfit and he goes to third world countries and studies the coffee crop and decides what has to be done, the soil, and what plants to bring in and crossbreed. Then the volunteers follow him in and help him to develop a crop where they don't have to be third world countries anymore. And it's very rewarding to him, but primarily he gets to go to meetings all over the world. He speaks Spanish fluently, so he goes to meetings in Central America, South America, in Africa. One of his favorite meetings in Zambia, Africa, for God's sakes. They love him because there's only six of them. He makes seven whenever he comes. And so AA has been very good to him. Our eldest daughter kind of went wrong. She's been in Al-Anon about 25 years now. Can't win them all. My wife and my daughter are two of the greatest examples I have ever seen of the program, 1 through 12. They're two of the greatest examples I have ever known, 1 through 12. They have completely changed their lives, and I honor Al-Anon. I have the highest respect for Al-Anon. I don't understand you, but, you know, you're the kind of people, you know, eat a Mexican dinner, drink a half a bottle of beer, and then walk away. I can stand that. I don't want to think about it. And, optimist says the glass is half full, the pessimist says half empty, and the alcoholic says, you going to finish that? But I just did all that service, and Mother Teresa was in our area many years ago, and she had a heart attack, and she was in the hospital there, and one a friend of mine was a cardiologist, helped take care of her, and he said, Cliff, you couldn't be in the room with that woman and not know she was a spiritual person. And when she was in the hospital, this reporter asked her a question, and she answered it, and it was in the paper. And I cut out her answer and carried it in my wallet till it turned yellow, you know, and wasted away. And what she said to the reporter was, the fruit of faith is love. And the fruit of love is service. And the fruit of service is peace. I will comprehend the word serenity, and I will know peace. And the fruit of service is peace. And so this lady and I have been trudging this road now for 41 years each. I'm a little ahead of her, but that's all right. And I have never picked up a coffee cup in Alcoholics Anonymous where I haven't been repaid a billion times. I've never done anything for anybody in Alcoholics Anonymous that didn't repay me a million times. Answer the phone. Or else I'm hearing things again. And so I'm so grateful to be here. I'm so grateful to be here with you. And I honor you. And I thank you for making this part of your 20th anniversary. Thanks.
Now, for the rebuttal, we get to really hear what happened. You know, Al-Anon's remember. So now we have my dear friend, Pat.
And he is a dear friend. Hi, I'm Pat, a very, very, very grateful Al-Anon. Not always. Said I was grateful, to tell you the truth. Sometimes Al-Anon was a pain because it, you know, what you're supposed to do. I don't want to do that. I don't want to forget something. When we spoke here before, I have no idea how many years, a bunch, because I was given this little guitar that says 7 o'clock, let's rock. Now, I'm a pack rat, I admit, but I was going through a bunch of stuff and tossing out a lot of it. I thought that showed a lot of discipline. And I picked that up and I thought, no, that's just sentimental. I'm not going to part with that. And it wasn't very long before we were invited to come and speak here. So I kept it right handy. So, you know, it means a lot to me to be here. It means a lot to both of us. The wonderful people we know, have known, and it has good, strong element. That's important. I love that. I'm not going to give a rebuttal. I hope. I've learned not to do that. It's hard, though. He's funny as hell, isn't he? And I've all the years I've heard him talk, there's always something in there I haven't heard before. And I just roar. I still laugh at it. Matter of fact, he was telling me what to say just a minute ago. Which is telling how you met me. Well, I always do, so I don't want you to tell me that, but... You know, I was raised in a household with a lot of laughter. My mother was very, very funny lady. An alcoholic lady, but not that... She was not critical. She was just loads of fun. She would just get drunk and come sit in the corner in a rocking chair and pass out. Well, just to get on the phone, and now this is going back a lot of years, folks. I'm almost 83, so I was a little kid. No, you know, I remember when I was about 10, and we had a phone on the wall that you picked up the receiver, and you talked to the operator. This was in Los Gatos, California, a very small town at that time. And the trouble was, she would get up at midnight, because why do alcoholics make calls at midnight? Does anybody else have that? We're still getting them from a nephew of his back in Oklahoma. And she would, of course, the operator would answer, and everybody knew everybody. And she would say, I want to talk to Hazel. And the operator would say, Hazel's asleep, Polly. I'm not going to wake her up. And that's how I knew what she was doing, you see. Because Hazel, I mean, the operator was our cousin anyway. So. One of the big things in our household was keeping secrets, even though it was a pretty happy household and the secrets weren't too gruesome. But we didn't talk about that. We didn't talk about certain things. And that was one of them. Mom was real easy to keep a secret. She was just a little gal and kind of, you know, didn't make a lot of noise about her drinking. Now, I thought when I married this guy, and the trouble looked pretty bad, that I couldn't talk about it, but he was really hard to keep a secret. You might notice, you know, he's not shy. We were at San Jose State, 10 miles away where I go to college. And, well, you know, I don't remember when I met him, really. I think I was playing a ukulele and we were singing all together or something. But when I decided I wasn't going to let him get too far away, was we were all in a car going somewhere and he was singing like Donald Duck. You should hear it. Any Ellen on here knows, that's worth marrying right there. I mean, I was raised amongst laughter and love and a lot of humor, and here's this funny man. Mm-hmm. And that was for me. He still can sing like Donald Duck. He won't do it very often. I think, you know, I got to thinking about, we talk about ducks a lot in Ellen. And, you know, we talk about it. We're not supposed to say if we think somebody's an alcoholic, supposedly. You know, but if it walks like a duck and it talks like a duck, you know, and that's common. And then there's this man in Nebraska that I met who came into Al-Anon, and he told everybody that he thought he had his ducks pretty much in order. And the Al-Anons told him that they weren't his ducks. And that's Al-Anon right there, in a nutshell. He was talking about our daughter, our oldest daughter, she's a lot of fun. Willie knows her pretty well. And last night, well, our other daughter was in the hospital again for those things that we go through when we have alcoholism in our family. And our daughter Kitty, the oldest one, who is a nurse, and she shows up with stuff in order to make sure somebody's getting at least the right kind of medical care. And so she had been at the hospital, and we didn't go. And we've learned not to do that. You know, we don't need to be there. And later, Kitty called me to kind of just, you know, get it out of her system. And I'm back there talking on the phone back in the bedroom, and I'm laughing my head off. So is she, by the way. I came out about a half hour later, and Cliff says, what on earth's so funny? Because, you know, it wasn't funny, but it was funny. You know, people that are hallucinating could say awful funny things. And you know, we just had to laugh. That's all. We cared. But we've learned in Al-Anon that we just can't suffer because of that. We just can't suffer. We're sad for our daughter. She's sad for her sister. We hope for the best. We all can. But we can't let it weigh us down. And isn't that a wonderful gift? That is so so precious, and a lot of people don't get that. So, you know, our life is in session, as Carol T. always says. Life is in session. I know some people here, no, not here, Pat and Candy, we miss them. They're having the same situation right now. You know, that's what we live with. But in Al-Anon, and AA to some extent, is just so freeing. And I didn't want it. I don't like that kind of freedom. I mean, I was pissed off when I came here. Can you say that? Pissed off. I don't sit down in the deep south, I'll tell you. But, you know, I didn't want to come to Al-Anon. I'd been, God, I'd been doing everything for that man. Everything. I kept that speech team going. I'd be on the phone. He'd be on the phone. We didn't have more than one phone then. He'd be on the phone making arrangements for the bus to take the kids to the tournament. And I knew he was going to forget everything the next morning because he was drunk. So I'm listening with my long ear. And I'd make notes. And then I'd send him off with his notes the next morning to you know, he wouldn't lose his job and wouldn't be disgraceful. And then I got him to go on an abuse one time. Now, that's an experience. Well, he went to a psychiatrist. He was willing. I don't know. He was guilty. That's when you get it, you know, the morning after. You get him the morning after, you know, when he sits in his listening position and I'm in my talking position. Oh, what a scene, what a scene. And the psychiatrist prescribed the interviews. Well, I didn't know anything about it, but I did know that when he took it, you know, he wasn't supposed to drink, and he didn't for a while. He would drink, I don't know how long, not very long. And then he would drink, and things would happen. He would turn really red. You're not supposed to drink on antabuse. For those of you who don't know what that is, alcohol does not react well in the body with antabuse. It could kill you, actually. He would turn red, and he would just get real anxious, and that was kind of fun, actually. You know, but it was kind of scary, so me and my great wisdom, since I'm bindered in sciences, I go down to the UCSD library, medical library, like I knew what I was doing. And I looked up the formula for interviews. Yeah, there is one. And I don't know what I was thinking, but I figured out a way that he could I knew he couldn't stay sober, that he could safely drink on Monday. No, he could safely take an interview on Monday and on Tuesday and half of one on Wednesday, and he could safely drink on Friday. I knew he would not make it. But he always drank on Thursday. And he really was weird. He would he'd turn red and strange, and he'd just be all jittery and anxious and scared. And we had a house full of people a lot. We lived in a cul-de-sac where we raised our family. We're a real social family. Not only was our house full of drunk teachers a lot, but neighborhood kids, especially with my son's business, because there were a lot of attractions there, you know. And my mother, who had a serious drinking problem by this time, had come to live with us. She was on a little walker because she'd fallen and broken her hip, but she didn't remember how that happened. And, so she was living with us, and it was a very, very busy household. So there were people around a lot. And it got kind of interesting because he'd be there a lot on the floor, just trembling. And I'd just be saying, Serge is right. You know, but it became, you know, that's the night that Mr. Roach turns red, is Thursday night. It was just became a neighborhood. There was just a cul-de-sac, and all the kids all knew each other. It was crazy. He's what he said, it was crazy. He didn't say a lot about, we had a lot of fun. A lot of fun. He did say he had fun drinking, but our family had a lot of fun. Just, oh God, we just had great times. Everybody in the family is funny. how come, I wonder, you know, with that. And today, everybody loves everybody. Today, they're not sniping at each other. Even with something going on that's difficult, they're not, one isn't getting behind the other back or deciding who's doing something wrong. That wasn't always true back then, as you might guess. And I was keeping track of these five kids. I also gave piano lessons because God knows we needed the money. Now, I didn't know how to give piano lessons. I got to tell you that right off the bat. But, you know, pre-Al-Anon, I'd try it. And I was teaching, I could play, and I was teaching a kid, and it seemed to work out. And another person asked me, and another, and before I knew it, I was teaching a whole lot of piano lessons. Well, meanwhile, we had built a family room on. So we had the house with me and my piano studio, the living room, teaching. And the back of the house is a family room with kids, and they were going in and out the back door a lot. Well, they were coming in and out the front door for piano lessons, but in and out the back door for other reasons. And it was a very busy house. But I was trying to keep a dignified piano studio. Now that was, and you know, I did pretty well. It was hard though with this particular man. Like he'd gone down to, he went surfing in Mexico a lot. And he bought a Mexican art object one time, a large carved wood, with a particular figure extended, about 18 inches high. And he brought it home and he said, put it on my piano. And he said, this is my philosophy of life. But by this time, I had gotten too scared to go against anything. I think some other people in the room might have had fear. I was afraid to make waves. But I couldn't leave that thing there while I was giving piano lessons. So I would, of course, sneak it out just before, and then get it back in before he knew that I hadn't had it there. Except, you know, one day I just forgot it. And that, wouldn't you know, that's the day that the kid's mother says, can I come and listen to his lessons today? And I noticed she's not looking at anything, me or the student, she's looking at something on the piano. And, you know, there it was, his philosophy of life for all to see. And now, that's hard to keep a dignified piano studio when you have somebody there. I never saw them again, by the way. He was the wife of the Baptist minister. So. And you know, another time, I had the piano so that the student couldn't see the room. And their backs were to the room. Our living room, our house was set up so one door came in from one side and one went into the hallway from the other. So you could circle through the whole house if you wanted to. I was teaching a child to play something called Humoresque. And I don't know, you don't need to know what it is. It's just a dancey little number. It's got a nice little beat. It's really kind of common to teach kids. And out of one end of the living room comes this man wearing white boxer shorts with little devils on them, which I had given him, of course, for Valentine's Day, with the rose in his mouth leaping across. Now you've met him, so you can imagine. It's funny. It was so funny. Now, how do you stay mad at somebody? You know, I often think living with alcoholism is like playing with slot machines, because he would pay off just often enough. I was actually thought of that one time when I was in Reno, and sitting there, and the guy next to me was really making money from his, and I'm sitting, he got up and left. Quarter machine, I mean, cheapskate. And then he got up and left, and I thought, maybe I'll go over to his machine. You know, it's really paying off. And then I think, no, I put too much into this one. it's just such a metaphor. And somebody else might come along and get the payoff. And that's exactly what I did with him. I'm not going to get him, you know, leave him go out in the world and have him get okay, and somebody else gets him after all the years of work. But I didn't want to come into Al-Anon. I was sick and tired of all that stuff. Sick and tired of doing everything for him, because you see, I didn't know what Al-Anon was. I just knew it was one more thing about him. But one day, his little sponsor, who was a crazy little man, and he only lived half a block away, and he would burst in my front door, completely startle me. We didn't have a doorbell that worked because of the little drinking thing around that. But it was scary. He'd be there, he'd be. He wouldn't phone ahead, he wouldn't even knock. He'd just be standing next to me at the kitchen sink. And I go, Phil, you know, and I thought that was rude. He was a rude little man. And he would talk about going to Al-Anon. And I'd say, Bill, don't need to do that. I was a psychology major. Excuse me, I should have told you that in the beginning. And I was, you know. He was a drama major. And and the drama students love me because they want attention. That's what they do. And, of course, that's what I do, is listen. Yeah, that's sick, too, by the way, in its own way. I don't know where I was. I hadn't thought of this in so long. Do you know where I was?
Bill.
Oh, yeah, Bill's down there. So I'm telling him I don't need to go. I don't need to do this thing. And he would go away. Then he'd go back again. But on St. Patrick's Day of 1970, and I remember this because it was St. Patrick's Day, and it's the first time in a lot of years there wasn't a lot of booze going through our house because he'd been sober a couple months. He came to the house and he had some literature. No, he did that the time before, too. I used to give that to the lady next door. What could I learn? I knew it all. And he did something different. He sat down and he said, you know, I checked out the Al-Anon meeting in Oceanside. Now, it's a small town then, and there were what we call, laughingly, 1.5 meetings. One was reliably going to happen, and that was a Wednesday night, and the other one may or may not. You didn't know if anybody would be there or not. That's, of course, changed over the years. And he said, you know, I checked that out, and I think they could use your help. Here I am. I said, went to the meeting that night. And of course I did. He figured me out, that sly little alcoholic. And of course I came to love him. I came to love him. And so I came to my first meeting of Al-Anon, and all ready to help this group of people. And you were very nice to me. There were probably 10 or 12 people at the meeting. And I paid attention, and I was curious. I probably contributed something stupid. I don't know if I did or not, but knowing me then, I'm sure I did. And after the meeting, one of the ladies there, we called her, to her, behind her back, we called her Old Millie, because she was old. But boy, that woman was into service. And she said, next week when you come, assuming I would, will you stand at the door and greet newcomers? And I answered her, she never forgot this, by the way, till she died. I said, oh, I'd be happy to. I was in a sorority and I know how to manage receiving lines. Can you imagine Millie's reaction? Oh, she never showed it. Later she did. She never let me forget it. So I keep my obligation. So I went back the next week and I stood at the door. Now, you know, I don't know how often we got a newcomer there, rarely. You know, not that often, but there was one. Now, I remember this practically word for word, because I was unknowingly giving service with the worst possible motives. Didn't matter. I was doing it anyway. And a newcomer came, and she said her name. And I said mine, and she says, I'm scared. And I said, so am I. First time I knew I was that scared. A newcomer said the words for me. Now, when we talk about being of service and what we get back, it's kind of sneaky sometimes, you know? Don't know you're getting it. But when I think of that, I think, what if there hadn't been a newcomer? You know, I wouldn't probably go back again unless they asked me to do something. What if there hadn't been one? Just enough to keep me there and open my mind just a little bit. And I just kept coming, and I've never stopped, ever. Some months later, Millie, this was in 1970, she was participating in organizing the San Diego Intergroup, which at that time there was none. And so some of the people that knew what they were doing were in San Diego putting together a bylaws, and Millie was part of that. So she claimed she didn't drive. I'm not sure about that, because I think she just wanted me to drive her. So she said, will you drive me to San Diego? Well, I was, of course I would, for the worst reasons. And I went down there and listened to these people. Now, I had no role to play. I couldn't be a smart ass because I wasn't part of it. I was just there. I was the transportation. And they began working on this thing, and then they began getting really nasty with each other. Now, if you've ever been in a service meeting, or on a committee for a convention, you know, sometimes it brings out our worst personality traits, if you've ever noticed. And I guess that's what was happening, but they were really not nice. And I never had that happen in an alimony. And I was sitting there, and it really scared me. I thought, this is what happens in alimony. Well, of course, some wise person said, listen to us. We're not putting principles above personalities. They held hands, and they said the serenity prayer. And I watched that wonderful tradition happen. I didn't read it. I didn't read it out loud to people. I didn't analyze it. I watched it in action. And I knew it. I knew something happened. I knew I was somehow learning something wonderful. Actually, and that's why I say it's kind of sneaky. I had the worst possible motives to do these things. Show off, whatever it was. That night, it worked pretty fast for me, actually. When I went home, our then 14-year-old daughter was demanding she could go, whatever, spend the night someplace I wouldn't let her or something like that. And she wasn't a very nice kid. She was probably already getting her story together for AA. And she would say, you know, and I said, no, I'm not going to let you do that. Now, I would give in to her a lot because she was such a bratty little loudmouth that she got the worst treatment from her father, which I didn't blame him. You know, he was just more willing to do it. And so I would be nicer to her. So somehow balance it, which of course gave her not even one responsible parent. So I was, you know, normally I would give in to that because she would talk me into it. And I didn't. And I said, you're not going to go. And she says, I hate you. Well, I've never heard that one before. And I said, well, it's more important for me to like myself than it is for you to like me. I don't know where those words came from to you. I never would have thought I'd say something like that. It just flowed out of me. But I'd just come from that meeting. And I began to understand principles about personalities. I also began learning, and there were things I wanted to do that I was afraid to do. And I would complain, whine about it. I was a martyr. Millie called me a varsity martyr member. I have a big letter M she gave me. I still have it. And now you resented that. I'm not being a martyr. I'm being helpful. I'm the one making the sacrifices. I just did it again. Ooh. Where'd I go? I'll be back in a minute.
You're a big martyr.
Oh, no, I was somewhere else, but that's all right. I don't know where I was. Oh, I'm talking about, being afraid to do things. And so I was whining about that at a meeting. I didn't want to do this. I remember what it was the other day. It really took me years to remember. The movie Oliver was playing. I wanted to take the kids to see it. And there was an objection from the other side, from him. He didn't think we should do that. I have no idea why. He probably doesn't either. But I wasn't going to take them. In my old days, I would not have taken them. Because he'd be angry. So she said to me, well, take him to see the movie. And I said, no, he'll be mad. And she said, well, let him be mad. With such a, what? Let him be mad? I mean, it was so every day, the way she said it, like, doesn't everybody act that way? Let him be mad. Never occurred to me to just let him be mad. And there I got the courage. Then I took the kids to see Oliver. I didn't think he even knew the difference. I doubt if he paid attention to us, telling the truth. But behind it all, of course, was this strange place I got myself into to where I didn't do what I should be doing. No, I didn't do the right thing with my children. My inventory consisted a lot more of omissions than anything else. Particularly, and I think a lot of mothers say this, particularly not protecting them as much as I certainly would today. And it was all because of fear, mainly. And it was fear, it was selfish fear. It was fear about what it would look like out there. It was fear about having a scene. It was just the fear about my looking bad. It always had to do with me. And I didn't see that now and on for quite a while, but eventually I did. Eventually I began recognizing when you surrender that need to be right, to be so scared and not be able to do anything and just give it up and say, I'll just be scared and do it anyway. That's not a thought I had. Just do it anyway. it's such a freedom. I mean, I had no idea it was that much of a freedom. Surrendering to win, we call it in here. And so little by little, I began going ahead and doing things while I was scared. And gradually, I wasn't scared anymore about it. And gradually, I don't care if he's angry or not. You know, if there was going to be damage, then it's different. But now, I'm going to be angry. What a concept. And how would I, all my years of university studying in psychology, and I didn't even know that. God, you know, what a shame. Well, I'm still working, actually. And I would never get that to the people that think I know something. But so far I'd come, because I didn't grow up with a lot of anger, and I didn't grow up with being criticized, hardly ever. I was given applause. Everything I did was applauded. I was mightily loved, and I never questioned it. I don't know how my sister felt about me, but that's different. My mom and dad loved me. I never questioned it. That's a nice thing. Everybody doesn't get that. So when I got into a marriage with alcoholism in its worst form, which he admits readily, I had no clue what to do. I thought I could control that because I'd been able to control my mother's drinking. That's a laugh, but I thought I did. And it looked like I did sometimes. I told her she should stop, and she did. So I thought, I've got a lot of power there. And, you know, she started again. I never thought about that. But and all this need to control and the gradual release of not needing to control, of just letting it be, it's like not running to the hospital last night. I don't have to be there. I don't have to be there in pain. I don't even have to see it. I don't really want to. I don't want the memories and the vision. I don't need that. And it's not new. You know, it's awful, but it's not new. And my daughter did it, my older daughter, so, you know, and she's more equipped to do that anyway. But just the feeling of not even questioning it. Just release it. Release her with love. We used to say that more. It's called detachment now. Just release her to the hands of God, or a higher power, if you will. And trust. And I learned somehow, along the line, I don't know when, to start believing that no matter what happened in my life, I was going to be okay. I was going to be okay, no matter what. And I really believe that to my very soul today. I have no idea how that developed. It just became part of me. And it's so much part of me that sometimes I'm not paying attention enough, you know, when I should be. I didn't know what that meant, to just let people do what they do, because I was there to help people do what I thought they should do. That was my job. It's still my job. I keep it separate, real separate, Al-Anon, in the work I do. Although I mostly send people to Al-Anon, I'm not making much money. Or AA, you know. That's kind of fun, by the way. No, nothing more fun than tricking a client into finding their way into AA and not knowing. But it's just loads of fun. They come back, it's three meetings. Of course, I know the meetings. I know if they've gone or not, you know. Well, I say, you don't have to pay me next time if you go to three meetings. So they don't, you know, they go. And they tell me, and I say, yeah. And I said, you know, I don't think I need to come here. I think AA is probably where I need to be. Right, you know, then, well, there goes another payment out the door. But, you know, it's so easy. It's just so easy. Somebody's applauding back there. There's a lot of people in my profession that don't know what they're doing when it comes to alcoholism. Or they do know what they're doing, but they misuse the position they're in. They misuse it, and that's not a good thing. But little by little, people are learning. I don't know why I'm even talking about that. Just because I did, you know, just because I did. Sometimes it comes to my mind. Some of you are probably working in fields where you could have a conflict if you let it happen. But there's nothing like Al-Anon or AA when that's what's needed. And it's just a lot of fun. And my colleagues are learning from me, because they'll come and talk to me about a case they have, and what do you think here, we do that. I'll say, send them to Al-Anon, you know, just as clear as anything to be. Oh, really? Yeah, send them to Al-Anon. And that's kind of fun. And I get to tell them what to do. years ago when I was given piano lessons, I had become so unable to recognize the little gifts of life, little things. I remember we had lived in a terrible town called Manteca for 3 years while he got his first 3 years of teaching it. And I went back there to speak, actually, in Helena one time. And it was fall, and I took my oldest daughter. And the leaves were changing, because that's a place where they do that. And I said, Kitty, I don't remember the leaves changing here. We lived there 3 years. I don't remember these colors. She says, oh, Mom, they always change. I couldn't see the colors. I hadn't known that until I went back there. But the day came, and I'm going to stop talking. A little boy, I was teaching a little boy, a real talented little guy. And if you know anything about music, you don't have to know much. There's something called grace notes. And grace notes are little bitty notes. Just look at a sheet of music, you'll see them probably. Little notes that precede the main beat. They don't count in the count, they just slip in. They're pretty. They make it nice. You'd know if you heard them. And one time he said, Ms. Rush, what are those little notes up there? I said, oh, just ignore those. See, I didn't even teach grace notes, let alone appreciate them. I'll tell you today, I don't miss a grace note. And I hope that you can appreciate the grace notes all around you, too. Thank you.